Lecture 7, The Environment and Negative Externalities.
This lecture marks something of a shift of emphasis. For the last several lectures, what we've been doing is talking through the various different microeconomic markets, goods market, the labor market, the capital market, and how households and firms interact in those three markets. What we want to do now and for the rest of these microeconomics lectures is talk about some examples of what economists refer to as market failure. That is, cases where the market doesn't work out in a way that we would probably prefer. Those examples include situations of pollution and a clean environment, situations of education and technology, situations where a market can lead to poverty and inequality, and situations where it can lead to monopoly or various kinds of difficulties in insurance markets and in other kinds of markets. This lecture, we want to focus in on the environment. The fundamental question I guess most people begin with is, are economists the enemy of environmentalists? Are economists opposed to environmentalists somehow? A few years ago, when I went to a friend's wedding, he put me at a table next to someone who worked for an environmental foundation. And later I asked him if there was any special reason, and he said, well, he thought we would have a good fight. He thought it was sort of fun to have someone who was an economist sitting next to someone who was an environmentalist, and we could have a good argument with each other. Actually, I found that we didn't really have any argument at all. We both enjoyed each other's company a lot. I'm someone who likes to canoe, I like to hike, I like to bicycle, and so I certainly don't feel like being an economist is somehow antithetical to understanding that there's a lot of value and good things out there in a clean environment and being out in the air. When you think about it, in fact, this sort of connection between economics and the environment gets trickier as you sort of look around the world at different things that are happening in different countries. For example, consider some of the communist countries of the world, particularly, say, Russia and Eastern Europe. They certainly did not have what you would call free market economies. They were heavily government planned. But if you look at what happened in those countries to their environment, they were incredibly dirty. I mean, they had much more in the way of pollution problems, dirty air, dirty water, toxins, people exposed to unsafe substances than do the market economies in Europe or in the United States. If you look at very poor countries in the world, third world countries in Latin America or in Africa, you often find tremendous environmental problems having to do with deforestation, having to do with drought, having to do with water tables being ruined and destroyed. Again, you find extraordinary problems even though you would hardly say that that happens because these countries are rich. They're not. They're dirt poor. And it certainly doesn't happen because they have big market economies. Their economies are often very heavily controlled by the government. So I would suggest that these examples tell us something. They tell us that it's not the free market versus the environment. What it really is humanity versus the environment. People are going to have some sort of an environmental impact. And when we think about the economy and its interaction with the environment, what we want to think about is how to make that interaction as positive as we can, to include the value of the environment in what we do. Now, the way in which economists think about this idea of interactions with the environment comes through a term called externalities. What do economists mean by the idea of an externality? Let's go back to first principles. One of the reasons that markets work well is that they allow gains for voluntary exchange. They allow buyers and sellers to come together, and as people buy and sell, then both sides can be better off. However, what happens if you have a buyer and a seller who make an exchange, but that exchange also affects some third party who is not part of the exchange, was not included in the price, was not included in the negotiation? That third party who is external to the negotiation is affected by what we would call an externality. Let me give you an example of an externality, and I should say specifically here that when I talk about the third party, I'm not just saying that the third party is unhappy with this deal, that the third party wishes they hadn't done it, that the third party wishes they had purchased or sold instead, or the third party is upset with the deal. I mean that the third party was actually hurt in some direct and immediate way. Let me give you this example. Let's think about living in two different apartment buildings. And in one of those apartment buildings, it's New Year's, and they plan a big New Year's party. All the people in that apartment building get together, and they hire a really loud band. And the really loud band plays in a way which shakes the roots of both apartment buildings. Now, in the apartment building which hired the band, people in that apartment building got together, they hired the band, so presumably you've got a willing buyer, a willing seller, they're happy to be hired, they're happy that they were to hire, you've got a good party going in that group. What we're interested in is the people who live in the other apartment building. They were not the buyers, they were not the sellers, but they're the people who are not able to go to sleep on New Year's Eve because their building is shaking from the loud band next door. They're suffering an externality. Now, that externality could be a positive externality. It could be a negative externality. Imagine, for example, this is a really good band, perhaps even a great band. In that case, the people in the other apartment building are getting a free concert of music they like. So they're external to the deal, but they're happy about it. They're essentially getting something for nothing. On the flip side, it might be that the people in the other apartment building hate that band. They hate the music. They wish it wasn't disturbing their evening. In that case, they're still suffering. They're still being affected by it. They're still suffering an externality. But in this case, it would be a negative externality. In common language, we would just call that externality noise pollution. And in general, pollution is almost always a case of an externality. That is, it's a case where there's a willing buyer and a willing seller, but some third party who wasn't part of that deal is being affected in one way or another. The difficulty, of course, is that when the market doesn't take you into account, then you're no longer efficient in the sense that we were using things before. There's someone involved here who's not being made happy. They're not part of this deal where both sides are feeling better off. And since the market is no longer focused on making both sides feel better off, it's focused on making some people feel better and some people feel worse, we're now in a complicated situation. What I want to do in this lecture is focus in on negative externalities, in particular talk about pollution and environmental issues. What we'll talk about in the following lecture will then be positive externalities, which involve things like technology and education, where people who didn't pay for something may benefit from its presence. Pollution to economists is just a case of a negative externality. It's something that's imposed as a result of the actions of others, and you suffer pollution with inadequate or no compensation. And that's why we call it pollution. One way to think about pollution is to think about it as divergence between private costs and social costs. Now, what do I mean by that exactly? When you think about a firm producing something, you think about a firm supplying something, remember that their willingness to supply is based in part on their costs as compared to how much money they can get for the item. If they can get a lot of money and it doesn't cost them too much, then they'll go ahead and make a lot of whatever it is. So when producers are looking and trying to figure out how do we make as much profit as we can, they just look at their private costs, their costs for labor, their costs for machines, the costs they have to pay. However, in the case of an externality like pollution, we would say that that firm doesn't just have private costs, it also has social costs. It has costs of producing clean air or dirty water, and other people are suffering through those social costs. The firm, however, doesn't have to pay for them. In a way, it's like the firm is able to dump its garbage for free. Instead of being actual garbage in bags, though, it's dumping garbage for free by putting it into the air or putting it into the water. If you can dump garbage for free, you'll dump it any place, any time. It's a cost that you don't have to carry. In the case of the loud band in the next door apartment, for example, the difficulty was that the people who hired that band didn't have to take into account when they hired the band that there was this extra cost that other people in the neighboring apartment were going to have to suffer. Now, let's think for a moment. What would happen if you did have to take your social costs into account? What would happen in the apartment building example if the people in the first apartment had to go over to the people in the second apartment and say, okay, we're going to hire a really loud band. And because we're going to hire a really loud band, we want to compensate you for the inconvenience. We're going to offer you, $50. And you can go out to dinner and enjoy yourself on New Year's Eve, and, you know, we'll pay for all or part of it. We'll hire that band, but we will pay for our social costs. We'll pay for the inconvenience that we're imposing on you. Now, of course, if they had to do that, if they had to take the social cost into account, it's possible that because of that extra cost, they might say, well, we're not going to hire that particular band. Or we're going to hire them, but they're going to play fewer hours because we don't want to pay so much for inconvenience. Or we're going to get some other room somewhere that won't have so much noise. In one way or another, if they had to pay for the social cost, they would have an incentive to reduce those social costs. That basic insight that if you have to pay for the social cost, if you have to pay for the pollution, then you have some reason to try and reduce the amount of pollution, is how economists think about the idea of a negative externality. The problem should be to make people recognize that they're imposing social costs and take those social costs into account. Well, what are the different ways in which we could bring social costs and benefits into line? There are a variety of different possibilities of different policy tools. First one, and the one that I think most of us think about when we first think about environmental law, is what economists call command and control regulation. Examples of command and control regulation would be things like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and a lot of the environmental laws that started being passed around 1970 or late 1960s and then have been updated every few years ever since. The basic notion of a command and control law is that you set some sort of a level. You say, this is how much pollution you're allowed to emit. That's it. There's a limit. So we're going to command how much you can let out, and we're going to control it. And that approach of saying setting a regulation and keeping it in place is certainly a workable approach. That approach, I think, has really done extremely well for the United States. This isn't always widely known because so many people worry about a dirty environment, but the environment in the United States is actually quite a bit cleaner now than it was 30 years ago as a result of many of these command and control laws. Certainly there are places like the air over Los Angeles or the air over Denver where certain rivers or lakes which are still polluted, and there are problems of toxins out there. I'm not trying to say we live in a sunny, clean, and perfect world. But if you go back 30 years and you look at the average levels of pollution in the air, the average levels of pollution in the water, you'll see quickly that things are actually much, much cleaner now as a result of building plants for treating wastewater, as a result of the laws we've passed, as a result of putting emissions things on car engines and on smokestacks. I think in a way that's very encouraging. Environmental laws certainly can work and can have a positive effect, and we can clean up the environment to some extent. In fact, it's encouraging that the environment has gotten cleaner over the last 25 years and the economy has grown at the same time. And when people say, well, there's a conflict between the environment and the economy, I sometimes think, well, actually, in the last 30 years, there hasn't been a heck of a lot of conflict. The economy has gotten richer and the environment has gotten cleaner at the same time. In fact, a lot of economists would argue there's a connection here. The connection is that as a society gets richer and richer, it's more and more willing to pay for a clean environment. If you live in a poor society, a society where people really have very little money, they're living close to the edge, of course they're going to have to pollute their environment. They have no money to pay for anything else. They're going to need to chop down all the local trees, to deforest things. They can't pay to dispose of things in a clean or a safe way. So in a way, it may be true that far from a rich economy and the environment being enemies, it's possible that to some extent they are allies. However, although this command and control regulation has worked pretty well, we have had real gains, real successes, there are some significant problems with it, which have become more and more apparent over time. And let me lay out three of these problems. One problem is the problem of what economists call regulatory capture. Regulatory capture just refers to the problem that those who are being regulated have a tendency to capture the regulators and be able to tell them what to do. Now, why exactly is this? I mean, sometimes people sort of talk about this as if it were a clever or scheming plot. There's a little bit of plot in it maybe, but there's also just a lot of reality. The reality is, if you've got a regulator who's looking at smokestacks and setting certain limits all the time, who is it who's going to spend all their time and energy focused on that regulator, focused on giving them information, focused on seeing who's appointed to that board, focused on giving people who leave the board nice jobs after they've left it, all those kinds of connections and pressures? Well, the answer, of course, is the person or the organizations who have the biggest incentive to focus on the regulators are those people being regulated, those firms being regulated. And sure, you can save a spot for consumers, you can save a spot for environmentalists, but even as you try and save a spot or two, what you're really conceding is that the information and the pressure and the energy behind that regulation is to a large extent going to be coming from all the people who are being regulated. So one of the common things you see with regulation is that over a period of time, it seems to become more and more friendly to whoever is being regulated. And if you believe in command and control regulation, one of the things you need to remember is command and control regulation are not being set by you and a group of your friends. Command and control regulations are being set through a political process with people who are chosen and appointed in political ways. And you want to remember that that's who actually is going to be carrying it out in practice. Those standards may not be as tough over time as one would actually like. A second possibility, our second difficulty with command and control regulation. The government, often in command and control regulation, dictates specifically what pollution control process is going to be used. It might say, for example, if you're going to prevent emissions of sulfur dioxide from smokestacks, you have to put a scrubber on the top of the smokestack to remove that pollution. That's the specific technical approach you need to use. You're not allowed, in other words, to use other alternatives, like using coal that has less sulfur, perhaps, as one possibility, or other things within the plant that might remove the sulfur earlier or at a different stage. There's a specific kind of technology you have to use. Now, that may be good technology. In some cases, it may even be the best technology. But then there are many, many different plants built at many, many different times, with many, many different ages and many, many different production processes. Usually, it's good to have some flexibility. Often, the people who run the plant are the ones in the best position to decide whether this particular method or that particular method is a better way of removing pollution. And when the government comes in and dictates one particular method, they remove that flexibility. They try to impose a one-size-fits-all kind of solution. A third difficulty with command and control regulation is that there's no reason to go beyond what the regulation imposes. Say that there's some level of pollution that's set, and you work your way down and down and down and down until you're just below that level. Well, now you're on the right side of the law, you're below that level. Should you continue to reduce pollution further? Should you make any effort to reduce pollution further? Well, with a command and control regulation, there's no reason to. As long as you're under whatever the level is, just a little bit under, that's sufficient. You're together with the law. So there's no incentive to go out and try and come up with new ways of reducing pollution further or faster, as long as you're complying with the law as it stands. Now those problems imply, if you think about them as a group, that is the problem regulators may capture the process, that there's no flexibility in the process, and that there's no reason to go further, that we may not be getting as much for our pollution control dollar as we would like to get. Because we don't have a very flexible system, we may be spending more than we really need to clean up the environment. And some economists, who I think are also environmentalists, I do think the two can go together, have estimated that it may be that of the $200 billion we spend right about now on cleaning up the environment every year, that we could probably spend about $100 billion and get the same amount of cleanup. Or spend the same $200 million and get much more cleanup if we allowed more flexibility and if we provided better incentives. I'll talk about that flexibility and incentives a little bit as we work our way along. So, if we say command and control regulation has some problems, then what's the next place to turn? A next approach would be, and a more economically oriented approach, would be pollution taxes and pollution charges. The idea of a pollution tax or pollution charge is that you have to pay a certain amount for every bit of pollution you emit. So if you emit sulfur dioxide into the air, if you emit dirty water, if you emit soot, whatever you do, there would be a tax. And that tax would be something which was set in such a way as to reflect the social cost that that pollution is imposing on others in terms of their health or their quality of life or other things that one might think about. What are the advantages of pollution taxes and charges as opposed to command and control regulation? Well, there's several very nice features. One feature, of course, is that if you have a tax or a charge, the government gets some money out of it. So if the government gets some money out of it, they're at least better off in terms of not having to impose other kinds of taxes on income, or they've got some money to spend on other kinds of government programs. If you have regulations, the government has to spend money enforcing those regulations, but it doesn't get any revenue out of it. A second thing is that if you have a pollution tax or a charge, you give the firm a reason, an incentive, to reduce pollution. After all, if they can figure out a way to cut down the amount of pollution, to bring it down, every time they reduce the amount of pollution, their pollution tax goes down as well. If they can figure out a way to produce without polluting, then they can eliminate the pollution tax altogether. This lets the power of the market and the power of competition begin to work on firms and give them an incentive to reduce pollution. Imagine that you're competing with some other firm and you're both paying the same pollution tax. If you can figure out some way to reduce your amount of pollution, then you reduce your pollution tax and you'll be able to compete better against that other firm. You'll be able to undersell them. You'll be able to earn higher profits. So a pollution tax takes the power of the market, the power of market competition, the power of competitive forces and profit-seeking and selfishness, and says, hey, let's take all those very powerful forces and let's hook them up to a clean environment. A third advantage of pollution taxes and charges is that they are far less intrusive than command and control regulation. A pollution tax or a pollution charge doesn't care what method you use. It doesn't care what approach you use. It doesn't say you have to put this kind of thing on the smokestack, you have to insert this kind of machine. All it says is you get taxed at the end of the day for how much pollution comes out of your smokestack, how much comes out of your pipe into the lake or into the stream. And so it gives the company complete flexibility to seek out whatever the best ways are to reduce pollution at the lowest cost. Now, from an economics point of view, those advantages, money for the government, reasons to innovate, go beyond the standard, keep trying to come up with new ways to reduce pollution, and allowing great flexibility, those are great advantages from an economic point of view. They tend to be outweighed politically by a word, and the word is tax. Politically, if you say a pollution tax, when you say the word tax, you've made it very difficult for that to pass. Economists thus talk about things like pollution charges. A charge seems acceptable to people politically, even when a tax is not acceptable. The difference between them is purely semantic. I don't care what you call it. I just think that there's a lot of sense in trying to think about making people have their actions reflect the social cost of what they impose. A third approach, general approach to reducing pollution, is the approach of marketable permits. Marketable permits are another economically oriented way of trying to reduce pollution. The idea of a marketable permit would be that instead of having a tax, we give everyone a permit for emitting a certain amount of pollution. And they are able to buy or sell those permits. That's why the word marketable permits comes in. So as they buy and sell these permits back and forth to each other, those companies which can produce pollution or cut pollution in the least expensive ways and can figure out ways to cut pollution a lot cheaply, they will have extra permits to sell. And they will sell those permits to other companies which don't have cheap and easy ways of cutting pollution. Now, this idea of buying and selling permits makes a lot of people queasy. Let me add one extra ingredient that might make you feel better about it, and it's the way these marketable permits usually work. That is, these marketable permits automatically decrease over time. That is, you might have a right to buy a certain amount of to emit a certain amount of pollution this year, but next year it'll be down to 80% of that amount. And the year after that it'll be 60% of the original amount. And the year after that it'll be 40% of the original amount. So, you do have a permit, but that permit is slowly shrinking the amount of pollution that you can emit over time. This is actually how the United States went about phasing out lead from gasoline. We went to all the refineries that produced lead and we gave them a permit to emit a certain amount of lead when they were refining gasoline. But that permit slowly disappeared over time. It's also how we're going about trying to reduce sulfur dioxide emissions from electrical utilities. We gave all the utilities permits for how much they could emit in terms of sulfur dioxide, but we're slowly reducing that amount over time. Now, from an economic point of view, what's attractive about these marketable permits? Again, the main advantage is that you can sell the permit. And since you can buy and sell the permit, you have a reason to try and reduce pollution. If you reduce pollution, after all, and you have extra permits, you can sell them. And that reduction in pollution is worth money to you. So there's now a reason to innovate. There's a reason to reduce the amount of pollution beyond what the normal standard is. The main difficulty, I would say, with marketable permits is that they can be somewhat difficult in terms of geographic problems. For example, imagine two firms, one that emits pollution in Los Angeles, where the air is really terrible, and one that emits pollution in, say, Minneapolis, where the air is really pretty good. It probably wouldn't make sense to say, okay, we're going to let the Minneapolis firm sell permits to pollute to the Los Angeles firm. Because the air is already so bad in Los Angeles that you wouldn't want to make it any worse. You wouldn't want clean air places increasing the pollution of dirty air places. So when you think about geographically trading these permits across space and across time, it can get a little bit tricky. But there are definitely some cases, and air pollution in general is a pretty good case, where a lot of the pollution that's up there is just up there, and the problem is that it's in the atmosphere circulating around the world. And if we can take it out of the atmosphere, out of circulating around the world, we'll be better off, even though we can't say specifically where it came from in one way or another. A fourth way of reducing pollution, a fourth overall approach, is what's sometimes called a property rights approach. And a property rights approach is associated with work of Ronald Coase, who's a Nobel laureate economist, won his Nobel Prize, in the mid-80s. Coase had a really interesting insight about pollution. He gave the example of a train which is going by a farmer's field. And he said, let's think about that train going by the farmer's field, and let's say this is an old-fashioned train. It gives off sparks as it goes by the farmer's field. Now, these sparks could set the field on fire. That would be the pollution we're worried about right now, the fact that sparks from the train could set a fire. Coase said, let's think about this situation in two different ways. First of all, let's think about it as a situation where the farmer has a right, a property right, not to have their field set on fire by the train. And because the farmer has that right, it's up to the train to figure out what to do to prevent that from happening. The alternative situation is, now let's imagine that the train has a right to emit sparks, however it wants to. And let's say that the train has the right to emit sparks, and it's up to the farmer to deal with the fact that those sparks might set something on fire. Now, Coase said, the real difference here is, it's a question of who's got the responsibility. Does the farmer have the responsibility? Does the owner of the train have the responsibility? In one case, the owner of the train has to take action. In the other case, the person who runs the farm has to take action. But now here's the interesting point, I think. Coase said, whoever takes action, what that person will want to do is pick the cheapest way of preventing the sparks from hitting the field. If it's the farmer wants to pick the cheapest way. If it's the train owner wants to pick the cheapest way. And so if the cheapest way is the same thing, you know, that there's only one cheapest way, what will actually happen is that giving the property right to the farmer or the train owner will result in exactly the same action being taken. They will each seek out what the cheapest way is and put the cheapest way of doing it in place. The only difference is who ends up paying. Either one will reduce pollution in the cheapest way. The difference is who ends up paying overall. Now, let's think about that example for a moment. It's commonly applied in modern terms, not so much to trains and fields, but to situations like the conservation of elephants in Africa. This may sound like a bit of a jump, but hang with me here. If the elephants are just wandering around and no one has a property right to the elephants, no one owns them, no one gets any money from them, then the people who live around those elephants have an incentive to be poachers or to help poachers, because that's the only way they can make any money from the elephants. But if you say to all the people who live around the elephants, you now own these elephants. You own the elephants, we're going to let you sell Kodak film and lead tourists out there, and you know that in the future, making money for you depends on these elephants being healthy and well and on their environment being in good shape. Then, all of a sudden, you're in a situation where those people have an incentive to look after the elephants. So the question of whether people have an incentive to look after something or not is based to a large extent on their own property right, on the extent to which they personally can benefit from something. So when we think about who benefits and who suffers from different things, it's important to think about who owns it and who has a property right in one way or another. That doesn't always help you solve a pollution problem, but it often helps you think through who should be responsible and who you would like to be responsible. Because a lot of the time, pollution problems really are a situation where nobody has a property right. And if nobody has a property right, no one has a reason to try and fix what's going on, then you just have difficulties that happen. You're just going to have pollution, and there's no way around it. In general, the approach that economists favor for most environmental issues is to use the command and control regulations as a backstop.
use them to avoid really terrible situations, very extreme levels of pollution, particularly terrible toxins. But in general, economists favor moving toward the use of more market-oriented things. For example, using the charges and taxes, pollution charges, using the marketable permits, or using some sort of property rights arrangement to try and make things better. To try and illustrate how these might work in a particular example, let's think about the case of the greenhouse effect. And as I'm sure most of you know, the greenhouse effect is the idea that there's going to be lots of carbon emitted into the atmosphere. And because there's a lot of carbon in the atmosphere, the globe will generally warm up and global warming will cause various difficulties. There's a big scientific argument over how much this is true and the extent that it's true. Let me just ignore that argument for the moment and assume that this is something that we believe. There's some probability of it happening. And since there's some probability of it happening, it makes some sense to take some steps to try and reduce the risk. Now let's consider different alternatives for reducing the risk. A command and control approach might say, for example, to reduce carbon emissions, we'll cut down on the amount of carbon coming out of the tailpipes of automobiles. And a way of doing that, which we've been using for some years now, is the Corporate Auto Fuel Economy Standard, sometimes known as CAFE, after the initials of Corporate Auto Fuel Economy. The idea of a Corporate Auto Fuel Economy Standards is that if we have higher mileage on all the cars, they'll burn less gasoline, and less gasoline would mean that over time we would emit less carbon. So, that's one possible approach. That approach can work to some extent, but it has all the difficulties you would expect of command and control regulation. You set certain fuel economy standards for cars, but they don't apply to light trucks, and then everyone starts driving light trucks instead, and then they have a different standard. Or you have a situation where all the auto companies go to the regulator and say, hey, these fuel economy standards are just too tough. We're not able to meet them. And the regulators say, oh, well, I guess you're right. They are too tough. So we'll relax them a little bit over time. And that kind of relaxation, that kind of capture of the regulatory authority has happened over time. There's also no reason for the car companies to be out there innovating, trying to get really, really high mileage cars. All they really should be trying to do is just beat the fuel economy standard by a little bit. So you can do these fuel economy standards, but they have all the difficulties you would expect of command and control regulation. Now let's think about an alternative, a pollution charge. In this case, a gasoline tax. Well, a gasoline tax could also reduce the amount that we would have of pollution, of carbon in the air, reduce it by encouraging people to drive less. Because after all, if you have a pollution tax, then people are going to try and figure out ways to do other things. Now, a pollution tax, like a gas tax, might encourage automobile companies to come up with higher mileage cars. So that could be an offspring of the gasoline tax. But there could be other approaches too. People changing their driving patterns, people keeping their engines better tuned, people putting air in their tires to make sure they get better mileage. There are a whole variety of things that can happen as a result of a gasoline tax that go well beyond the idea of just having higher mileage cars. So it's a much more flexible approach. It gathers some money for the government, and it does provide some incentive for people to start thinking about how can we come up with different ways of reducing this to avoid this gas tax. But even a gas tax, if you think about it, is probably not exactly right. If we want to have a true pollution tax, we shouldn't tax all gasoline. We should tax the amount of carbon that's in the gasoline. If we tax the amount of carbon in the gasoline, then we give the gasoline companies and the oil companies reasons to reformulate their gasoline, to come up with new kinds of gasoline that would have less carbon in them. And because those new forms of gasoline could not have to pay any carbon tax, then, or pay a lesser carbon tax, then they would be able to undersell their competitors. And you would not only have all the incentives we already talked about, but now you bring in an incentive for oil and gas companies to provide cleaner gasoline than before. You could also do something with marketable permits, where you would say something about all of those who burn pollution or burn different kinds of carbon-based fuels will get a certain permit for how much they can burn, whether it's an electrical utility, whether it's a gasoline refining plant, whatever. And as they get those marketable permits, we'll have those permits decline over time and reduce the amount of gasoline gradually, allow those permits to be bought and sold. Now, my point in this example is similar to a point I was trying to make back in Lecture 3, I believe. point is that when economists talk about problems with command and control regulation, or they talk about certain kinds of trade-offs that happen, the economists are not saying that we are against the goal of a clean environment. The whole issue here is not, are you for or against a clean environment, or how strongly are you for or against it. It's not about the intensity of one's feelings. The entire question here is, what are the best tools to use? Which tools will get us the cleanest environment at the lowest cost? And that's all we're trying to accomplish in thinking about this as economists. I'm making the argument that command and control regulation, while it certainly can be beneficial in some ways, is a gawky, clumsy, awkward, costly way of fixing things. And that these other sorts of tools, pollution taxes, marketable permits, property rights type things, are going to be able to reduce pollution at lower cost, more flexibly, and get us more bang for our buck. That's not a matter of being pro-business or whatever, it's just a matter of being sensible, about trying to make sure that whatever your goal is, you get to it in the best way that you can, so we can get as much environmental cleanup as possible. Now, this approach, although I've tried my best to defend it a little bit here, definitely seems immoral to some people. I ran into a quotation a couple of years ago where someone said, "For some environmentalists, criticizing their beliefs on economic grounds is like criticizing Holy Communion on nutritional grounds. It kind of misses the point." If you just believe in the environment as a sort of holy goal of one sort or another, then this idea that there's going to be trade-offs, we're going to balance things out, may seem to be something which just misses the point to you. People could be very much in favor of reductions in pollution, but other people just feel pollution is wrong, it's a sin. The goal should be zero pollution. The goal shouldn't be some sort of polite balance of different things. When you talk about a right to pollute, a marketable permit, a permit to pollute, a permit you can sell, people get very excited about that. They begin to feel as if you're selling something which really should be sacred, which really should be holy. The best answer, I think, to that line of thought comes by way of a story from George Bernard Shaw, which I hope won't offend anyone. I don't intend it for it to offend anyone, but it makes a point well. The story told by Shaw, who, as many of you probably know, is a witty and brilliant man, involves Shaw at a party. Many stories begin with George Bernard Shaw at a party. A woman comes up to Shaw, and they're having some conversation, and it's, of course, not going very well because Shaw was a prickly and unpleasant person. And he says to the woman, "Well, they're just talking about one thing or another," and he says, "Well, tell me, would you sleep with me for £1 million? And the woman says, "Well, I don't know. I suppose I would." And Shaw said, "Well, would you sleep with me £5? And the woman said, "Well, of course not, sir. What do you think I am?" Shaw said, "Madam, we have already established what you are. All we are now doing is haggling over the price." Now, the reason for telling that story is that when it comes to pollution, all we're doing is haggling over the price. We are all polluters. There's just no getting away from it. In a modern world, you know, we give off sewage, we give off, we use metals, we use cloth, we drive cars, we are watching products which are shipped and made in plastics, which are made in chemical factories. There is no way to live a perfect green life. Even if you were living on a desert island somewhere, you would have to worry about disposing of your own human waste. There's always an issue of how much pollution you emit. This idea that we should have zero pollution, that zero pollution is a goal, strikes me as unrealistic to the point of being silly. The goal is not zero pollution. Zero is saying there should be no humans. The goal is that we should have the right balance between the benefits of the economy and the benefits of a clean environment. And in order to strike that balance, we need to think some about what the gains are and what the benefits are, what the costs and the benefits are. So, just thinking about this notion of saying, "Well, you're a polluter, you don't believe in zero pollution," to me that doesn't go anyplace. It doesn't mean anything, it doesn't go anywhere. The point that you want to make is, are you someone who's got the wrong trade-off, who would push too far toward pollution and not enough back toward other things? Economics doesn't take a moral stand. It doesn't say, you know, we're going to be in a situation here where we abstractly, we believe in zero pollution, and because we believe in zero pollution, that's the stance we're going to take, and we're going to hold to it through right and wrong. Economists are into practical morality. Practical morality says there's going to be some pollution. Now, I think there should be less. I'm in favor of big pollution taxes. I would be in favor of quite a high gasoline tax. I believe there are a lot of things we could do to reduce pollution and to preserve areas and to keep the environment cleaner than it is. This is not, for me, a statement that I don't think we should be doing things. However, if you say to me, well, we should have zero pollution, I say, well, we're just not talking anymore. You've gone off into a realm of abstract perfection, and we're not talking practical consequences and practical ways things ought to work. So we have this argument for negative externalities. We have this argument for pollution. How far, at the end of the day, does this critique go of the market? We are really making a powerful and, I think, an interesting argument here. The argument is that in an unrestricted market, if you just let the free market work, then there will be no incentive for producers to take pollution into account, to take those social costs into account. And because there's no incentive for them to take those social costs into account, they will produce a lot more pollution than we would like them to produce if they were taking those social costs into account. Now, if you think about pollution, you think about the different ways things get polluted, you think about air, water, noise, cigarette smoke, all the different ways in which pollution can happen, you begin to think, well, boy, I could imagine a whole lot of pollution taxes out there. I could imagine pollution taxes on many, many different items. I could imagine many, many different kinds of marketable permits. At the end of the day, we may be talking here about a fairly aggressive set of interventions in the free market. And I would emphasize it's a set of interventions in the free market which is allowed and indeed encouraged by economic thought. Now, where any of us ends up in terms of thinking about how far would we go, how many things would we impose, where do we just sort of say, for example, hey, if you're living in a big city, you got to put up with some noise. We're not going to put a noise tax on everything in sight. You know, if you're going to drive a car and live in an urban area, you got to put up with a little smoke in your air. We're not going to try and wipe out all air pollution. Where would you draw that line between how far do you go, how far do you push things? I think that line is something that lots of people can draw in different places. And I don't mean to try and nail something down now. But what I do want to say is of primary importance, if you're going to think as an economist, is that ignoring the market and just saying, well, I can ignore the market because there's an externality, that is clearly not the answer. The right approach here is to take that powerful animal of the market, that force, which, as we talked about in the first lecture, is a force that can make things like pencils. It's something that can feed cities. And take that extremely powerful force of the market and kind of bring environmental concerns into that force. Bring it into the force so that they can work on getting a cleaner environment and they can find some balance between the environment and the economic issues. So if you want to talk about raising pollution taxes, that's a perfectly legitimate sort of thing to talk about for me. I think that if environmentalism becomes a cause which has to say that it is against a higher standard of living, if environmentalism becomes a cause where you say the only way to be a good environmentalist is to live poor, is to live in a small house, is not to drive a car, is not to take advantage of benefits of technology, is not to have certain kinds of health care or medical care at your disposal. If environmentalism takes that turn, I think it's really going to lose its practical support and its political support. I think that would be a terrible loss. What we've really demonstrated in the last several decades in this country is that it's perfectly possible to have clean environmental growth and at the same time to have new technology developing. And I think one of the things the government could spend more time and energy on than it does is trying to figure out how to encourage clean environmental growth in a way which both raises the standard of living and protects the environment. The two can go hand in hand.